This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. So what happened to civility in American political debate? It's a question that's hard to avoid, especially if you're following the current presidential race or the various debates in Washington, not to mention many of the pundits who cover them.
This is a future of Barack Obama's America, who has gone to war against civic and community and religious organizations.
Broader point, that the far left in this country is essentially anti-American.
Oh, please.
They are.
Oh, that's
and
disgusting.
So a lot of
never in all the time I've been here in the Senate have I seen the kind of stubborn ideological rigidity guiding members of Congress the way these House members.
Who are you calling anti-American? I'm so tired of people calling people on my side anti-American.
Are you a far left guy?
Well, when you listen to sound bites like that, it's hardly surprising that more and more Americans are choosing to just tune them out. A recent poll found almost half of the American people don't even follow government or politics.
Nearly two-thirds of them say the reason is the tone and lack of civility in the public discourse. And many people believe it's been getting particularly harsh in recent years. In fact, it might have reached one of its low points back in 2009, when President Barack Obama tried to talk about immigration policy before a joint session of Congress.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally.
Well, that outburst, "you lie," was from South Carolina Republican Congressman Joe Wilson, and it was a particularly troubling example of what we're going to talk about now, whether or not public discourse is being strangled by hostile, toxic speech.
And joining us now is Ira Jackson. He's chair of the advisory board of the brand new Center for Civil Discourse at University of Massachusetts in Boston, which tomorrow will host a national forum called Civility and American Democracy. The event is also being co-sponsored by WBUR. And Ira Jackson, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
So why
and
do
thanks
we...
for sharing Tom Ashbrook with us tomorrow.
Yeah, he's going to be co-hosting that.
Yes.
And we'll be talking a little bit more about that in the segment. But tell us first why we need a Center for Civil Discourse.
Political discourse in America is on a path to paralysis. And the invective, the vitriol, the demagoguery, the toxic nature of our public debate is... I don't think making us any healthier or better informed, and maybe in this day and age we should bring it down to a financial calculation, but S&P, when they downgraded the U.S. bonds, said, it's basically a dysfunctional political space in America. So we're not Pollyannish. In fact, we've got a forum tomorrow that's going to bring 9 world-class scholars, not all of whom agree with our diagnosis, but some of us got together and said, can't we do better? Mustn't we do better as a democracy?
And let me ask you about that. What is the worst effect of what you would argue is uncivil discourse? Is it the fact that folks are tuning out, as we mentioned in that introduction?
I think in a democracy, that's the most dangerous single manifestation is alienation and then cynicism. If we have big money controlling our politics and two-thirds of our public and the future generations tuning out, then is it really a democracy? It's not the democracy that I think we envisioned. And I think we have to reclaim our democracy. And one way to do it, it's not a silver bullet. And we're not talking about a homogeneous kumbaya kind of democratic discussion. But let's have a little bit more respect for one another. Let's take a little bit more time delving into the substantive issues. And let's find creative solutions instead of simply painting the other guy and gal as the enemy.
And what are the solutions? And to that, let me ask, what does the Center for Civil Discourse hope to accomplish?
Well, we certainly don't prescribe a solution to the national deficit or the outcome of the war in Afghanistan or the crisis with Iran. But we think, I can't remember the scholar who said that war was too important to be left to the generals. Democracy is too important to be left to the talk show hosts and the 24/7 news cycle to which it's being held hostage. We need to re-engage the American public and responsible journalists and scholars in a deeper dive on what the issues are, what creative solutions might be, and a way forward that reclaims participation and a sense of ownership of the outcome of our democratic you know, polity.
Sure.
And what we call America.
And what do you think, Ira Jackson, if there's one thing, I mean, I'm sure there's more than one thing, but what's the biggest thing that drives incivility and the sort of coarseness in the public debate that we're all...
That would be my personal opinion. I'm not a scholar. I'm accompanied here by one of our nine distinguished scholars who will be sharing their scholarship with the public tomorrow at UMass Boston. But my hunch would be that... It's largely the influence of money, mm-hmm. and the corrosive effect that has had, the toxic effect that's had on our public discourse. And I think perhaps I'm not pointing at you, and certainly Charlie Kravitz and WBUR has been so supportive of this new Center for Civil Discourse at UMass Boston. BUR is part of the solution, but I think the media... And if you will, I don't want to be partisan, and we're totally nonpartisan, but the kind of invective that you hear on late night television is perhaps just yet another manifestation of how it's become more entertaining to be an adversary and to vilify the other person and to tune out the opposition than to engage in the public square and take on the adversary with respect, learn from them, and maybe evolve towards a way forward that is respectful and makes progress. I think we're in a trap. We are deeply dysfunctional as a society. We've let insoluble problems fester now to the critical point where we're now just screaming at one another, and that's not going to find our way to a solution. We're better than that.
So, listeners, we want to hear from you in this conversation. Has our public discourse reached such a fever pitch that it's poisoning public debate, hampering our democracy? Does there need to be a reset in how we respect one another? And if so, how do we do that? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And I'm joined in the studio by Ira Jackson. He's chair of the Advisory Board Center for Civil Discourse at UMass Boston. And Ira, you mentioned a distinguished scholar sitting to your right. John Stauffer is professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard University and one of the speakers at tomorrow's forum on civility and American democracy. And John Stauffer, thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So let me ask you, looking back at recent history, do you think that public debate has become more or less civil? Are we living in a particularly uncivil era?
We're living in a less civil era today than we have been for a few decades. But in the long scheme of things, from the Constitution until today, civility has overall improved dramatically.
It has improved.
Yes, right. It's improved. And for there are a number of reasons for that. One is for most of American history, blacks, women, minorities, agitators were silenced. And one of the easiest ways to preserve civility is to silence these agitators. Another is that through almost the entire, from the Constitution up through the early to mid-20th century, civility was always seen in terms of its opposite, which is barbarism. So if you were trying to preserve civility, you were attacking those who you considered to be barbaric. Mm. And that often descended into using savage means, either rhetorically or in some cases through violence, to preserve or enhance that civility, and that kind of binary no longer governs our understanding of civility.
I assume that you'd be in favor of what the Center for Civil Discourse is trying to accomplish.
Absolutely.
But what do we need to be careful of? That is, it's not a simple matter to just say people have to, you know, be more civil in their political discourse and everything's going to be okay. In other words, one person's incivility may be another person's agitation for necessary change. Right.
During periods of social reform, during periods of great ideological strife in which different sides are deeply passionate about specific issues, there needs to be an understanding that the sphere of civility in terms of what's tolerated needs to expand, and the voices are going to become more shrill, so that someone who fervently believes on religious grounds, on ideological grounds, that abortion is murder, they have a very good claim for being less respectful of their opponents. So there needs to be an expansion. It's in the same way with abolitionists. Mm. You know, Frederick Douglass was not exactly civil for many, if not for many whites, especially Southern whites. William Lloyd Garrison wasn't exactly civil. I think that the civil rights movement was a kind of model movement until 1968, in which you had this social revolution, and you were able to maintain a discourse of civility that was, given the social revolution, in certain respects, extraordinary.
Ira Jackson, what do you hear in John Stopher, sort of putting this in a historical perspective? Does it suggest that it's a little more complicated?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. We wouldn't have made progress. We wouldn't have been one nation. We wouldn't have abolished slavery. We wouldn't have had women's rights. We wouldn't have had gay and lesbian and transgender rights without a good deal of uncivil behavior, although I was reflecting with the professor before we came on the air that I remember Martin Luther King saying the great challenge of the civil rights era was to convert the heart of the racist sheriff. And we needed to be respectful of where he was coming from, meet him halfway, get in his head, listen to his concerns, and bring him to the center. Where we would meet. And I thought that was profoundly difficult and persuasive to me back then. So no one is denying the importance or the role of the Occupy movement or of the Tea Party. But what we are postulating, and it's arguable, but we're joined by a number of other academic institutions from Texas A&M to the University of Alaska, from Colby College to Claremont Graduate University, is can't we apply some scholarship? Can't we learn some lessons of history? And can't we model what we call democracy debates, which bring all those passions and creativity into the public space, but in a way that's highly educational and informative, and elucidates some way forward other than invective and personal recriminations.
Well, we've got some callers on the line, and we encourage you to call if you're listening, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking about the need to improve the public discourse, looking for ways to make the public debate more civil, if that's possible. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Kenmore Square. Hi, Richard.
Hi. First, I'd just like to give a quick definition of the difference between polite and civil discourse.
Sure.
Polite is where you don't say certain things lest there be violence, and civil is where you can say what you have to say and there won't be violence.
Oh, wow.
But you often don't know where that line is.
Yeah,
in other words, it's very common throughout American history among activists to use what one might call violent rhetoric, and in some cases it not leading to violence, and in other cases rhetoric that seems relatively tame that does lead to violence.
Okay, and so that brings the point that I wanted to make, because so far, as far as I understand, most of the sense of the sort of excessive and uncivil discourse coming from the right wing, I would just like to point out that we have an extremely virulent and I would say grossly excessive anti-Israel discourse that is widespread on campuses. We have apartheid week and so on, in which all sorts of really vicious claims are being made about Israel. And yet, on the other hand, when you criticize Islam, you're told that you're insulting them and that it's inappropriate.
Okay, Richard, let me sum this up in a way, because I don't want to get drawn down the avenue of debating Middle East policies in this segment. But your point that uncivil discourse can happen both on the right on the left. Fair point, Ira?
Totally agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Examples of that? I mean, our caller, Richard, made some. Are there others that we should be thinking about? Either one of you.
In recent times?
Sure.
Yeah, I was just saying to Ira that, for example, during the early, few decades ago, in the early period of the gay and lesbian rights movement, there was the famous case of in which gay activists pied in the face Anita Bryant for her very shrill rhetoric and in which she did demonize gays, but that's a great example of the left employing a kind of uncivil action, and it happens certainly on the right. I think a lot of Americans to this day, especially white Americans, would say that some of the statements that Malcolm X made, some of the statements that Stokely Carmichael made during civil rights were less than civil, although I disagree with that point.
Sure.
I'll offer a mea culpa. I was active in the anti-war movement. That dates me, and much of our action was quite uncivil, and much of the rhetoric that we used to castigate those who were opposed to us was absolutely abhorrent in retrospect. To refer to, I don't think I did, but many referred to the police as pigs. Many viewed soldiers as the enemies. Look at how far our society has come. However, our differences about Iraq and Afghanistan, the almost universal respect we have for those men and women serving in our armed forces, I think that's a good illustration of the role that civility can play, not in muting differences, but in injecting a mutual respect that is necessary in a democracy, especially a democracy that's dealing with the kind of intractable, complex issues that face us.
Sure. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Needham. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
My question to you is, in civil discourse, how would you suggest going about calling someone a liar? And I'm going to use the analogy of, if you don't call someone out for distorting the facts, pushing it incorrectly, then those facts or those non-facts that the person stated become perception, and that perception becomes reality. It's almost like the kids that, you know, in school, 2 + 2 = 5, and the teacher tells them, that's a great answer, it's ingenious, instead of saying, no, you're wrong, it's 4.
Paul, it's a great question. We certainly hear examples of lying in the political discourse. It is hard to call someone out and say, that's a lie, you're lying, it sounds uncivil. How do we deal with that?
Again, I don't have a prescription, but I think smart folks sitting around could figure out a new format. We've experienced 14 or 15 Republican presidential debates. I don't think we've learned a great deal from them about the issues, maybe a little bit about character or style. And then we get corrections the next day from the Washington Post or a fact checker. What if we reformatted political debates so that there was agreement on what the facts are? Or there was a mechanism for some sort of arbitration, not to call someone a liar, but to gain a more mutual understanding and respect for the complexity of what it is that we're discussing.
See, it sounds like a workable idea. On the other hand, and you mentioned this, Ira, earlier, it seems to me that one of the big pieces of the challenge here is about money and politics. And you know, I bring this up in the context of lying because I think it's appropriate to do so. And when you have outside groups that can spend masses of money on media campaigns and don't have to be necessarily responsible for what they say or for the truth, how do we deal with that short of, trying to taking another go at this campaign finance issue again, which seems to be lost for now in the wake of the Citizens United case?
I completely agree with Ira. I think that the money has had a profoundly corrosive effect structurally as well. If you're only given a sound bite in which to correct a false statement, it's very hard to do that. The easy answer is to just accuse someone of lying. The civil answer is to acknowledge the complicated issue at stake and to correct someone with facts, or to say it's actually a little more complicated than that, as in the example of Joe Wilson calling Obama a liar.
Sure.
It was much more complicated than the statement "you lie" would suggest. And that structure is made problematic because of the role that money has in our public discourse, especially political discourse.
It's a big, big challenge.
I'd be missing an opportunity, Anthony, if I didn't hopelessly shill for our center and suggest and hope that someone will make a modest investment to make our work alive and real. I think, you know, the Koch brothers, George Soros, they all have a role. And until we change the Constitution or the law, that's going to be the way it is. But I don't think we are incapable of working at solutions short of legislative or constitutional to to reclaim our democracy in ways that we haven't been creative enough. I analogize, I hope this isn't fantastic or fanciful on my part, all that creative energy that went into financial engineering, those subprime mortgage loans, what if they had been instead applied to figuring out how we make housing affordable for folks and in a way that was responsible? Well, we could have avoided, you know, $50 trillion worth of mistakes and 50 million people worldwide being unemployed. What if we could apply some of our creative passions as a society on problem solving instead of invective and partisan posturing? So we're not going to come up with all the solutions.
Sure.
But you've got 600 listeners who have already signed on and will be present with us tomorrow at UMass Boston. And on your website here at WBUR, they can participate through live webcasting and listen to erudite professors, Diana Eck, Jill Lepore, Randall Kennedy, John Stauffer, and others who are going to be doing a much better job than I have exploring this issue through a variety of lenses of scholarship.
John Stauffer, I just wanted to come back to you. We were talking about this before the mics went on, were turned on for this segment, and you mentioned at the beginning that political discourse has always been pretty rough in this in this country, and most of us recall this great anecdote. I mean, we weren't born, we weren't around then, but Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, who was practically beaten to death in the Senate, right, by a rival senator with a cane back in 1856.
Yes.
I guess we can be somewhat encouraged that
That
sort of stuff doesn't happen anymore.
Fist fights, getting hit on the head, Sumner getting cane was an extreme example, but from the Constitution through the postbellum period, fights in Congress and bloodshed in Congress was not at all an uncommon affair, and especially in the 1850s. By the late 1850s, many, if not most, Southern senators and representatives packed heat when they went to Congress.
Packed heat, meaning they were armed.
They were armed with Bowie knives, with pistols, in some cases with shotguns. And they would wave their Bowie knives to their opponents.
Well, Ira Jackson, we've come a long way since then, but clearly we've got some ways to go. So thank you for coming in and talking about this effort.
Thanks for having us.
That's Ira Jackson. He's chair of the advisory board for the brand new Center for Civil Discourse at UMass Boston. He's also a distinguished fellow at MIT. And John Stauffer, professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard University and one of the speakers at tomorrow's Forum on Civility and American Democracy. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the forum begins tomorrow morning at 8. It's going to be moderated by WBUR's Tom Ashbrook. Tickets are sold out, but the entire event will be simulcast live on the web for free. And you can find a lot more information at our website at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, he's joining the family business. Joe Kennedy III announces a run for Congress. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.